This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
Rather than focusing on trying to vandal-proof their design so that it can effectively withstand any kind of antisocial behavior, designers really need to think more about enhancing the experience for all users.
We look at how defensive architecture, those urban interventions that stop us sitting, lingering, and lolling, and how they're shaping our cities. Plus,
weaving has been seen as women's work for eons. There's a really interesting hierarchy between art and craft. I think Glenn Adamson said perhaps craft is just what we call what women do.
We learn to tell our warp from our weft with a new book about the ancient but fast reviving craft of weaving. We also air a special report on how Vienna Design Week is doing wonders for homegrown designers in the Austrian capital and beyond. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Now, on last week's show, we looked at how small and thoughtful design interventions can help us better enjoy the public space in our cities. But today, we delve into the debate on defensive or hostile architecture. Antisocial behaviour and vandalism are a sad fact of city life, and some designers, usually at the behest of companies or councils that own tranches of public space, have taken it upon themselves to create unwelcoming spaces. Think of benches with armbars through their centre to dissuade rough sleepers from resting on them, spikes to stop sitters, or ledges left intentionally narrow to stop people lingering or, heaven forfend, leaning on them. This show's producer, Daphne Karnizis, sat down with Barbara Penner, architectural historian at UCL's Bartlett School of Architecture, who picked some of her pet peeves when it comes to hostile architecture. But first, Penner started by explaining how this type of intervention began in the first place.
Defensive architecture, or as you called it, hostile architecture, really has quite surprising origins. It originated actually in the early 1960s with Jane Jacobs, who was a great champion of cities and street life. But Jacobs observed that one of the things that keeps streets safe is what she called eyes on the street, natural surveillance. And this idea got picked up in the 70s by someone called Oscar Newman, who was the one who first termed or came up with the term defensible architecture. In the 80s, defensible architecture became secured by design, which is this design philosophy that's been widely adopted by the police and the security services and so on. And something like the Camden Bench is a pure product of secured by design. And it's this idea that you can construct the built environment in such a way as to encourage the kind of behavior that you want, that you deem acceptable.
And limit others.
Deter people, in many cases, from antisocial behavior. What I find so interesting about defensive architecture was the way it started off as quite a positive philosophy. It was about embracing city life. But the way it has been manifested more recently, it's actually become, I would say, an active deterrent to a rich and vital city life.
So we'll come on to some specific examples now, but would you say that at the end of the day, it's actually ended up hindering our connection with public space more than bringing us closer to it?
It's certainly part of what I would call a hardening of the built environment. It's premised on a very different idea, which is that you somehow need to protect your streets and their amenities. Mm. So this results in all sorts of vandal-proof street furnishings that are incredibly uncomfortable for users, that don't encourage lingering, that don't encourage spending time and don't promote comfort in public space. And so the Camden bench is a really great example, I think. It came out in 2012. It's a concrete bench. It's made up of angular surfaces so that people can't sleep on them, but also so that skateboarders can't use them. It's meant to serve as a roadblock if necessary. So you've got a bench doubling as a roadblock, which immediately, I think, gives you a certain visual image. And it effectively is an obstacle, I think, in many cases. It's meant to steer users through space in a particular way. But in fact, it's, I would say, almost like a psychological barrier to free movement through space. The point, though, is that you've got this public amenity that the public doesn't want to use.
Would you say that, in your opinion, public space is public space that works well and is accessible to all is becoming increasingly scarce? I mean, is there a danger, particularly, of a clash between public and private interests?
I definitely think that there is a greater and greater encroachment into the public by the private. And you can see why it happens. We are in an age of austerity. Local authorities are still trying to provide services, but without the budgets that they used to have. And so increasingly, they are turning to corporate sponsors, for instance, to private companies to fill the funding gap. And this is why they're very often selling the one thing that they have, which is land, or offering up, as the case of the Superloo shows so well, public amenities for advertising space and trying to increase their revenues in that way. So while I see it happening everywhere and I deplore it, I also think that it's cash-strapped local authorities in this day and age don't actually have many choices.
Mm. What do you think, if anything, designers and city planners should be doing better?
I think too many designers and city planners have very uncritically embraced secured by design and genuinely think it's well-intentioned. They feel that they're delivering a safer urban environment that will enhance people's experience of public space. But I think they're ignoring the exclusionary nature of space and of their designs. And I think more open and creative engagement with the problem of the city would do much to help alleviate this kind of very tick box approach to the public realm. Designers really need to think more about enhancing the experience for all users rather than turning the antisocial behavior of a small minority into the driver of design.
Barbara Penner there, architectural historian at the UCL's Bartlett School, speaking to the show's producer, Daphne Karnesis. Now, a new book crossed our desks recently that looked at the applications of the ever-so-ancient art of weaving. The seemly title surveys over 20 working weavers and explores the craft's sometimes unlikely web of associations with everything from migration to technology. The book's author and our sometime commentator, Katie Tregidden, sat down again with Daphne Karnesis to spin a quick yarn.
Katie, thanks for joining me. First of all, how did the idea for the book come around? We've spoken to you before about design and crafts. Why weaving in particular?
So this is my second book with Lydian, the publisher. And the first book was called Urban Potters, Makers in the City. And that was very much in reflection of a trend that I think is widely known for studio pottery and young people getting involved in getting their hands in clay and making things and starting to make a living from that. And I suppose after the success of that book, the question we both had was, what next? And it was quite funny because Ruth said, I'd like you to do another book. And my immediate response was, is it going to be about weaving? So I think we both had the same idea that weaving is perhaps where studio pottery was 5 years ago. And it's interesting that there are a lot of open access making spaces for pottery, and we're just starting to see those now for weaving. So I think we felt that it was perhaps in an earlier place than pottery had been when we wrote that book, but definitely something that was on the up, very much on Instagram, and lots of young people getting involved, reinterpreting this ancient craft for our times, really. And there's a lot of truth in that. You know, our lives have become very clean, very sanitized, very screen-based. We're only really using sight and sound. We've sort of lost three of our senses in our world. So this idea of something that's very tactile, that smells lovely, there's a clackety-clack sound of the looms, I think that is an antidote from the digital world. I think there's also a sense that universities are closing craft courses because they take up a lot of space and they take up a lot of resource, so they're not profitable. Into that vacuum are coming open access studios, so the sort of places where you can just turn up and borrow a loom for an hour. And that means that students are using those spaces, or people who would have gone to university are using those spaces, but also people who have full-time jobs are coming on Saturday or in the evening. So it's actually, it's quite a contradictory statement, but as university courses close, other things come into their place that are in some ways more accessible. Mm-hmm. I think there's also a sense of big brands wanting to sort of get on the craft bandwagon. And so I think there's a renewed interest in weaving from that sense. And I think it's also about authenticity and transparency. You know, big brands have for a long time hidden their supply chains, and there are worries about where things come from and the people and practices involved in making them. And I think if you know you can buy something from the person who made it and you can see the whole supply chain, you know it's been ethically sourced. And a huge amount of the weavers in the book talk about, you know, where they get their yarn from, and they're very worried about the environmental impact and all of those sorts of things. And I think all of that is sort of coalescing together to drive this renewed interest in weaving.
And you do link in the book weaving to a lot of different social issues, gender and technology. Can you talk to me about some of those most important themes that you have linked it with?
The gender thing is fascinating. Weaving has been seen as women's work for, you know, eons. There's a really interesting hierarchy between art and craft. I think Glenn Adamson said perhaps craft is just what we call what women do. And there's this idea that actually there's nothing fundamentally different between the two practices. And in the book, I mentioned Glenn Adamson's comparison of a Pierre Mondrian painting and an Annie Albert's wall hanging. And actually, in every comparison, Annie Albert's wall hanging comes off better. But she herself said, you know, but as a woman weaving, there's something amateurish about it. And so I explored some of those ideas and then looked at how they affected the makers in the book. So interestingly, Brent Wadden is one of the few male weavers in the book, and he's one of the only weavers whose work is considered art and is hung in sort of mainstream big art galleries. And so I think some of those tensions are really interesting to explore. And it's sad that in some ways the issues facing Annie Albers in the Bauhaus are still facing women today. But yeah, that was really interesting to get into. And then the futures thing is fascinating, because actually we see weaving as this ancient craft and we tend to think of fabrics and very sort of simple textiles. But actually there's all sorts of exciting stuff happening. So there's a young lady called Jen Keane who's actually weaving with bacteria. And she's found we have all these high performance sports fabrics now, and actually they can't be replicated with cotton. So it's all very well to say, right, let's stop using plastic. But actually, as humans, we're now demanding things that natural materials aren't yet capable of giving us. Mm. And in weaving, material is stronger in one direction than the other, in traditional woven yarn. She's basically created a system whereby she lays down a mesh and then the bacteria weave in and out of it for her, which means it's strong in every direction, which means, I mean, it's very much a prototype stage. It still gets slimy when wet. But when she's resolved those issues, you've got high performance sports fabric that is made from natural materials, grown, so there's no wastage because it grows to the exact shape you want, and entirely biodegradable. biodegradable. So I think there's some really exciting things happening in weaving. There's also a guy who has used a Bolivian weaving technique to make a little implant that goes into babies with congenital heart failure. It's wonderful for many, many reasons, but the place where it comes from, there is a belief that if you have open heart surgery, that's damaging to your soul. And so the fact he's able to implant these little devices without having surgery means that not only do these kids survive at a much, much better rate, but also it's in keeping with their beliefs and their culture. So there's loads of really exciting...
Very varied applications.
Yeah, really exciting ways that weaving's being used. And I think the diversity in this book is one of the things that I found really exciting, not only amongst the weavers themselves, but also in some of the themes that I was able to write about in the essays.
And you met many, if not all, of the makers that you include in the book. How hands-on did you get? Do you weave yourself, or have you had any lessons even?
So interestingly, I had done pottery before I wrote the pottery book, so I felt a little bit more confident that I sort of understood some of the process. I am by no means a maker. I'm a writer. I have no expertise, and I wouldn't ever show anybody the things I made. But I hadn't weaved before I was commissioned to write this book, so I did go and do a weaving course and learnt to weave. And it's phenomenally complicated. And it's another interesting dichotomy that people see it as women's work, and yet it's hugely mathematical. Something we tend to see as a masculine trait. And it's really interesting that you can't really read a weaving pattern and weave and talk to somebody, or I can't anyway. And so it's quite a solitary pursuit. And I think whereas pottery is quite sociable because people can
multitask.
You can sort of lose yourself into the meditative process, and you can chat and you can do various things, and it becomes sort of about muscle memory. I think weaving is very mental. It takes up brain space as you're sort of following a pattern and making sure you've got your warp and your weft and everything all in the right place. That creates a different culture around it. So whereas pottery I found to be quite sociable, I think weaving is a much more solitary pursuit, which was an interesting difference that I hadn't necessarily expected.
Many thanks to Katie Tregidden, design journalist and author of a handsome new book entitled Weaving, Contemporary Makers on the Loom. It's published by Ludion and available at all self-respecting bookshops now. Now, over the weekend, the 12th instalment of Vienna Design Week wrapped up. The largest design festival in Austria, it's done wonders to promote homegrown designers, but it also makes a good point of extending its goodwill to other nearby nations. This year's honourable guest was Poland, and Polish design took centre stage in the festival's programme. Monocle's man in Vienna and one and only Alexei Korolev went along to the festival to talk to some of its participants.
What I see that Vienna Design Week developed its own format, a very Viennese format, and this idea of design, which is important for every aspect of life, became stronger and stronger.
I think the festival is developing. We are not trying to make more and more every year. We are trying to make things maybe better. And I think this has also developed over the years, that people understand what is the messages that Vienna Design Week tries to send.
Voices from Vienna Design Week. What started as a relatively low-key affair in 2007 has now grown into Austria's biggest design event of the year, transforming the way design is produced and consumed in this country. With an extensive programme spread across the city, each year there's a different theme, a different guest nation, and a different headquarters.
It's our 12th edition, and we also thought after the 12th year we can go to 7th district, which is the creative heart. We have Poland as a guest country this year, and I can say that after 12 years the festival changes so much every year that I don't get bored, not after 12 years at least.
That's Lili Hollein, founder and director of Vienna Design Week. At the Festivalzentrale, located on the grounds of a former hospital, she told me about one of the centerpieces of this year's festival, an exhibition called The ABCs of Polish Design.
The ABCs of Polish Design is a comprehensive exhibition about Polish design in the past 100 years. It goes from product design, of a graphic design, and I think it's a great possibility to get an overview of the Polish scene. It is one part of the contributions that Poland shows as a guest country. There's Signal to Symbol at the Polish Institute, again a graphic design exhibition. And then I think we have a very funny performative approach at the Festivalzentrale, which is done by the students of the Academy of Fine Arts in Warsaw. They took over the emergency room that we have at the hospital. So you get first-hand treatment by the students. And I have just done it again today, and they are excellent doctors.
One of the festival's recurring items is called Passionswege, or Ways of Passion.
It's actually, you might call it the format, or like the, a lot of people call it the heart of Vienna Design Week.
Gabriel Roland curated this year's Passionswege contributions.
And it's all about bringing crafts-based manufacturing companies together with contemporary design. We try to forego the normal relationship between a manufacturing company and a designer, this client-customer relationship. We're trying to break that open and create an environment where they work together as collaborators and really deeply explore the things that they're good at and the things that they can learn from the other side.
Let's look at one such collaboration.
My name is Laurits Galli. I'm an Austrian-born designer. I live and work in the Netherlands right now.
And so we are here. What is this place? Can you describe it?
Well, this is a traditional Viennese passementry manufacturer. I think it is the last one left in the city and also in this part of Austria. They are making passementry, so all kinds of tassels, fringes, all kinds of weird bands and ropes, everything you can think of in all different kinds of colors and shiny materials. And this is basically a practice is kind of dying out. So they're struggling. They're mostly producing for traditional entities like the army, the police, firemen. That's what they're doing, basically.
As part of this Passionswege, Loritz made 5 wall sconces using braid for ornament.
So this is one of the pieces, and they all follow the same principle. I choose something that is actually rather simple, which is the Vierkantschnur, which roughly translates to a square kind of rope. And it's usually used as an item of uniform. It's a certain kind of shoulder patch, and it decorates generals or any kind of army man. So this is usually used as a decorative element, and I made a whole object out of it. And I really like the way the light kind of flows with the curves. So I thought, okay, I want to just highlight that because it shows really well how beautiful this material is.
Hence the lamp.
Yeah, hence the lamp. So there's the light part. And then I thought, okay, let's just use lots of them. And so I just multiplied that.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
Thank you. Yeah.
Taking your heritage as an inspiration for your present work, I think is very important.
For Norbert Kettner, the head of the Vienna Tourist Board, it's projects like this that make Vienna Design Week so special.
That brings us back to the person of Lili Hollein, because she very much respects our heritage and she knows a lot about it, but never uses it as a corset. But always seeing this, where are the roots? But where are the free spaces to develop?
But is there any final destination you think, a finish line where you'll say, I've done everything I could. This is the best it can be.
Lili Hollein with some final thoughts.
There might be this point for me personally, but I hope it's not there for the festival, or at least not visible on my horizon. I think we have by far not achieved what it needs to build an awareness in a society apart from design professionals of what design can be, what design can do. So I think we have a long way to go there, and at the same time, design and also how designers understand their profession is changing and transforming a lot at the moment. So with these transformations, I think we will have enough reasons to go on.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolov.
Our sincere thanks to Monocle's radio correspondent in Vienna, Alexei Korolov. And it's with regret that that's all the time we have on this week's show. But don't forget, if you need a little design-themed inspiration, you can always delve deep into the pages of Monocle's monthly magazine, peruse our ever-growing library of books, or get hold of our weekly newspaper series. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis, edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans, and our sound engineer today was David Stevens. From Kraft to Kraftwerk, the German synth-pop band and pioneers of electronic music, we'll leave you with their 1978 song, The Model. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.